Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. And Stone, this is going to be a good one.
Hey, this is going to be a lot of fun, man. We got a studio full. We got paparazzi. We got communications professionals. We got elder law practitioners. We got chief sales officers. We got a lady who runs an entire association. It's going to be a fun information-packed session, I think.
All right. So let's kick it off with Matt Peavy. He is with Mitigation Management. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you.
Now, for the one or two people in the room that maybe aren't familiar with mitigation management, why don't you share a little bit about what you're doing for folks?
Yeah. So what we do, we go out, it's called mitigation banking. It's a program under the Clean Water Act when developers, say you have a Walmart that wants to fill in a stream or a wetland, or a DOT that wants to cross a stream. Well, they're impacting streams and wetlands, and under the Clean Water Act, they have to offset those impacts. So what we do, we go out and we purchase land and we restore the stream land that has impaired streams and wetlands. We go and restore those streams and wetlands on there, have it permit protection forever. We work with land trust on that. And then we get credits through the Army Corps of Engineers and the EPA. They award us these credits for crediting the environment. Then we debit those credits to developers, to DOT, to people who impact streams and wetlands. So there's a no net loss in each watershed in Georgia. And this is a national program.
And then, but you're working primarily in Georgia?
Georgia and Tennessee.
That's where your firm?
Our headquarters are in Athens, Georgia. Work a lot with the University of Georgia and the River Basin Center. And we have an office in Nashville as well.
Tennessee. So now, how did you get involved in this?
It's a long story. I worked for a home builder in Atlanta, and we had to purchase these credits before. And I was like, "What? Why do we have to purchase these? What are these credits?" And so started looking into it. And myself and Trey Evans started this back in 2006, and we're going for 12 years now, and started ourselves, and now 12 years later, we have about 12 employees currently in Athens, and we continue to grow our business.
So now your work is doing what every day? Like, you're the sales officer, so who are you selling to?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we sell to, Georgia Power, transmission lines impact streams and wetlands, pipelines impact streams and wetlands, developers, home builders, commercial developers, anybody who has a piece of property, they want to impact streams and wetlands on there. We work.
But there's
with them.
Tons of streams and wetlands, aren't there?
Yes, there are.
So, is it something that the developer thinks, "Oh, I'm going to just go in here and do this work," and then they're like, "Uh-oh, there's a stream. I got to do something."
Yeah, it's pretty planned out. So, all the good properties in Metro Atlanta are gone. So most of the ones that are left over have a stream on it, have some kind of hair on the project. And so people are going in there and they're like, "All right, we have this stream here. I want to put this commercial development on here. How do I do that? They got a stream here." And so they'll go in there and plan with the engineers and their environmental consultants and say, "All right, well, we can get this permit, and this will cost you X to offset those impacts."
So they're allowed to kind of remove the stream?
Either piping or fillings. And if it's a headwater stream, you can fill it. But
you create a new stream somewhere else.
Yes, that's what we do in the same watershed. So one of the misconceptions is that we're down in Valdosta, restoring a stream for Metro Atlanta. No, everything's by watershed. We're right here. We're in the Chattahoochee watershed.
Right.
So if you're in the Chattahoochee, we have to go out there and find a project in the Chattahoochee to restore those streams and wetlands on there to replace that function within that watershed. So it's every single watershed.
It's like a puzzle.
It is. So that's why we have over 30 projects in Georgia. We have all the different watersheds. We got coastal projects, got an island off the coast of Georgia that we're restoring for tidal marsh to sell to the Port Authority and the Navy and other people who are for the Kings Bay. We also have around Atlanta. So we put them all the different watersheds in Georgia.
So now walk me through how it works. Like, here, a developer, like here in Sandy Springs, I live here in Sandy Springs, and there's a stream behind my house, and that people are always looking to buy up all the old houses and put big properties.
Correct.
So what would happen if they did that? Like, so at some point they got to call you because they got to deal with the stream that's behind everybody's house.
Well, typically, yeah. Well, typically, if it's less than 100 feet of impact, that doesn't require mitigation. So these are like larger.
Ours is larger, so it's more than 100. So what happens?
If you want to pipe it?
Well, the developer comes in and goes, I want to buy out all these 20 houses.
Correct.
And then I want to put a mega subdivision here, but I got a stream right in the middle of this.
Correct. So what he'll do is he'll go in and assess that stream, and then he'll apply to the Army Corps of Engineers to say, all right, I want to impact this many linear feet of stream. Well, if you impact that amount of feet, you're going to have to buy this many credits. And there's a credit they have.
When do you get involved? Like, how do
I get involved after they get their permit approved?
How do they know to pick you to help them?
The Army Corps will help lead them. I mean, there's not very many people that do what I do. So we're about 80% of the sales in the state. It's a very niche industry. And so the Army Corps tell them they have a website called Ribbits you can go to. You can see where all the mitigation banks are, and they'll contact us. Typically, a consultant will come in and call us up first, and so we can go in and meet with that developer and tell them what that cost will look like. And so they know.
So sometimes they're not aware?
They should be aware if they have a good consultant working with them, but sometimes people aren't aware. But
they're like blindsided,
more so, not as much as they used to be, but sometimes.
So now, is there times when they're not allowed to kind of mess with?
Yeah.
The stream?
So if you go in there, and if your plan is too egregious, you have to meet like certain standards when your permit, like, is this an unavoidable impact? And so if you can't prove this is you have to impact this to do your development. If you can't prove that, then the Corps can deny your permit. Those don't happen very often, but they do happen.
And then so the Corps, the ones that are making the call.
Yeah. So it's actually interesting. So back in the Clean Water Act in the 70s, it was an EPA program, but the largest impactor of streams in the country is the Army Corps of Engineers. Think about the Mississippi, the rivers and
these ginormous
rivers. And so they're like, we're not going to have the military, the Pentagon's like, we're not going to have the EPA tell us what we can and can't do on this. And so the Army Corps is like, all right, this will be your program, but we'll administrate this program. And so it's an EPA program, but yet the Army administrates it because of all the national, the locks and dam system and all the military bases that need to go up and down the rivers.
Now, what's the timing when a developer is dealing with you guys? Is this something that you knock out like in days, or is this something that takes months?
Yeah. So it's for us getting a mitigation bank approved right now, it takes about 4 years.
4 years.
It takes about 4 years. So we have to go in there. We have to, the hydrology, we have to put wells and measure the groundwater. We have to prove scientifically how we're going to improve this wetland. It's a lot of science behind it. On the streams, we have to go in there and look at the fish and bug and water quality data. And we have to set a plan out and then construct it and then prove each year that all those factors are improving every year. And if they don't, we don't get credits. And so it takes us about 4 years for a bank. For a developer, if you're impacting over 300 feet and a tenth of an acre, you're going to have to get an individual permit. And that takes about a year to get a permit.
So when it's that amount of time, how far out are they planning these projects?
I mean, it's not easy developing these days. I mean, that's the reason why housing costs and everything are so much. It's not, there's some, the regulations today and everything. I mean, it takes a lot more planning than even when I was doing home building back in the early 2000s. I mean, it's a lot more regulations and hoops that everybody has to jump through. It takes a lot of planning to do developments these days, and that's just part of the process now.
Is it getting better or worse?
It's getting worse.
There's more regulation now?
It's not that there's more regulation. What happens with regulations over time, we see this in our industry, is that you'll have the same regulations, but then you'll have different people come in and have people have different interpretations. And if you don't have new regulations come in and to really solidify what's going on, the programs kind of run wild over time. So that's kind of what we're seeing in a lot of different.
Because you'll think something is a certain way based on previous rules, and then somebody else comes in and looks at the same exact rules and said, no, that didn't make it.
Yeah, well, things that are black and white over time, if you don't have new rules come out, it becomes grayer and grayer over time is what typically what we see.
Now, when you got into this, what are some of the projects you're most proud of?
Some of the projects I'm most proud of, just overall, we have conserved, I think it's around 5,000 acres in Georgia. And we have planted millions of trees. We have restored over 30 miles of stream in Georgia. All of that is permanently protected forever. We have a land trust. We have to go in and give a donation to a land trust. A land trust comes out once a year to make sure and maintain that property is being maintained over time and that nothing is being impacted. Those streams are still restored. Nobody's cutting down those trees. So we're a private company, and we're adding, you know, conservation, large scale conservation in the state.
So now, do you see any threats?
Some of the threats, you know, going back and forth. So streams and wetlands are regulated through Waters of the U.S. And we had, during the Obama administration, came out with a new definition of Waters of the U.S. It's a political football. And now Trump's wanting to come out with his own Waters of the U.S. So
what's an example of how they're different?
So we don't know what Trump's is yet, but we're pretty sure it's going to be, you know, a lot more deregulation. But it didn't really change much in Georgia. It added a lot of, in the Midwest, a lot of those prairie wetlands that don't have like a nexus going to if you have a big plains and you have like an isolated wetland, it was kind of grabbing a lot of those, and a lot of the farmers didn't like that. So they all kind of went out and really lobbied hard against Obama's WOTUS. And now Trump's coming back in and pulling all that out and going and taking a lot of our headwater streams out is what we think is coming out. And so this political football back and forth of the defining what a stream and what a wetland is, and we have all these underlying issues within the Army Corps. I mean, Army Corps still has to go in and scan every document into microfish. I mean, we're in the...
Wow.
That hasn't been done yet?
No. So they're still doing microfish. Jeez. And so, there's a lot of issues that they need, you know, help with. If you're an employee over there and you're having to scan all these documents into microfish, I mean, that's a lot of wasted time. You know, there's a lot of things that we could be focusing on and getting the agencies in the 21st century, them and a lot of the agencies, Fish and Wildlife, EPA, all of them could use a lot of help. And we're requiring all these crazy things on them, and we're just doing the political football back and forth. We're not really addressing some of the issues that could help out timing and everything.
Now, over the years, have you seen you kind of bullish or optimistic on how things are going, though, when in terms of how it's impacting the environment?
Yeah. So one thing, we work closely with the University of Georgia, the River Basin Center. And one thing that was going on in Georgia is that, so for every foot that people were impacting, only a third of that was getting mitigated. And by law, it's supposed to be, you know, a minimum of 1-to-1.
Right.
And so we worked with UGA, came out with this study, and it says that, you know, that's what was going on. And so now the Corps has changed the rules. Now we're more of a 1-to-1. So for every foot, you're having to replace a foot now.
And that's actually happening.
That's actually happening. It started March of this year. And so now we're selling more credits like we should have in the past. And so I think the market is getting better in Georgia. We're going to see more conservation, more restoration in Georgia through our industry.
So now who buys the credits? The developers?
Correct. Developers. DOT is really our number one purchaser. They're about 60% of the marketplace.
Because they're putting roads everywhere.
Yeah. Think about every time you cross a stream or cross a wetland on a road, they're having to get a permit and having to purchase mitigation credits.
Right. Wow.
So now who are your clients? Who are the people? Do you work both sides of the equation?
No. So, we don't go out there. Our client, we just sell credits to our clients, but we don't go out there and do the permit. We feel like that's a conflict because they're up there and tell you, you know, how many credits you need. It's very great.
How many do you want?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I'll sell you double if you want them. You want to help the environment, as I tell people all the time. But, you know, so I feel like that's a conflict. So we don't go out there and do that work. We work closely with a lot of Metro Atlanta and around the state environmental consultants who bring us on for the mitigation component of their permit and for their client, the purchase.
Are there a lot of environmental consultants?
The industry has shrunk somewhat. It's actually a good industry right now. There's not enough consultants, really. They're all very, very busy. Back in 2004, you know, there's a ton of environmental consultants. A lot of those is whittled down. There hasn't been a lot of people hired through the Great Recession in their industry. And so there's actually a lot of every single consultant I know is looking to hire people in this industry.
And they're around the state, or are they primarily in the metro area?
Around the entire state. I mean, even around Savannah, you have the harbor deepening down in Savannah. So we're seeing a lot of permits down there. We're seeing a lot of development down that area too. So there's also, that's where our headquarters are for the Corps is in Savannah.
That's where Georgia's?
That's where Georgia's is, correct.
Now, what do you need more of?
Right now, we're still looking to hire more environmental consultants. We're actually currently now hiring on construction, own construction crews. We're buying our own equipment, doing our own construction. There's so much development around Atlanta. It's very difficult for us to hire construction crews to come out and construct our streams and wetland banks. We have one right now in Monroe County. We have a 2-mile stream restoration project. We had to get a group from North Carolina to come in. And this cost from, you know, back in the mid 2000s to now has doubled on the construction side. So we were looking at spending on average $1 million back then. It's about $2 million now for construction. So we're trying to bring that in house and have a little bit more cost savings.
And then, so it's your own crews?
Correct.
That you'll send out.
Correct. That's what we're looking at now.
So now you're trying to get people to move from all over to do this kind of work?
Yeah. It's hard to find good help these days. So.
And what kind of experience or education do they need to do the work?
For the construction crew, as long as you used some heavy equipment, you know, but those guys are such in high demand right now. I mean, a lot of those guys are making six figures, which you would never believe. You know, I mean, they're hard guys. Good guys are hard to come by.
Wow. And if somebody wanted to learn more and have a more substantive conversation with you, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Through my email, matt@mitigationcredits.com.
And that's the website, mitigationcredits.com?
Yes.
Well, Matt, thank you so much for sharing your story today.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Hang with us. We've got a couple more guests.
Sounds good.
Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, Patricia Amari with the Amari Firm. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So how's your mitigation? You mitigating?
We mitigate other things.
I thought you guys would be more connected when I saw mitigation and lawyering. So, Patricia, tell us about your firm. Who do you serve?
So I serve families and seniors. And, you know, the idea is that we just want to help them with all of the legal issues that they may have as they age. And so that looks like different things. Sometimes we're contacted by the senior themselves, other times family members.
So now this is a specialty called elder law. Is that a new thing, elder law?
Or is it actually a relatively new thing. And actually, when I first started practicing, I wasn't even familiar with this area of law. And that's the case with a number of attorneys, interestingly enough. But it is an area that's growing. It first began in its baby steps in the 1980s. But we've really seen it grow over time. And right now, you know, with the aging of the baby boomers and whatnot, they're calling it the silver tsunami. And so it's an area that we're probably going to hear a lot more about. And I'm really excited to get to come and tell folks about it, because one of, you know, my missions as an elder law attorney is to let folks know that we exist and that there is help for certain issues out there, because I can't tell you how many times clients leave and they're like, I had no idea that there was someone that could help me with this problem.
So now, what are some of these problems that our elders are having?
Well, a lot of it stems with long-term care and paying for that long-term care. And I kind of have to explain what long-term care is, I think. What long-term care is it is an ongoing care for some sort of declining situation. So, for example, Alzheimer's or maybe Parkinson's disease. So it's the opposite of acute care. And acute care is what we're all familiar with, where someone goes in the hospital, they break a bone, they get assistance, they might get a little bit of rehab, but then they're on their way. And insurance covers that and Medicare covers that. But when it comes to long-term care, there's very few ways to cover that. And Medicare doesn't cover that. A lot of folks are really surprised to find that out. TRICARE doesn't cover that for veterans who are covered. And so we have to look at alternative ways. And so one of the things that I do is I meet with families and I help them to find those alternative ways and to plan for that. So some folks are there and they're ready for that care right now. And other folks are just concerned, well, what am I going to do when I need that care? And there are some pretty interesting statistics out there that say if folks that are 65 years or older now, that's probably about a 70% chance that they're going to need some sort of long-term care. And that may mean an assisted living or a nursing home, but it also may mean that they've got folks coming into the home to assist them, because most folks would love to stay in their home as long as possible. And we have a term for that. It's called aging in place. And so to the extent that I can assist with that, I want to do that as well.
So now you're helping the family kind of create a strategy to help manage the inevitability of getting older?
Exactly.
Like before that, people just said they would deal with it whenever the time came, and they didn't really put a strategy in place. And now that people are living longer, there's a need for someone to kind of quarterback this.
And that is true. A number of my clients have already had some sort of diagnosis. So a common scenario is a loved one, a spouse, possibly maybe a parent, has been diagnosed with Parkinson's or Alzheimer's, and it really brings it to the front of their mind.
And these are like kind of chronic forever diseases.
Correct. And so you know you're going to need some sort of care.
Right.
You don't know what that care is going to look like. But depending on how long you live, it could be significant care. And most folks don't have the savings to be able to cover that.
So what are the choices? When you say they don't have the savings, we're not just throwing people out on the streets, are we?
No, hopefully not. So basically what happens is one of the first things, is that Medicare, under certain circumstances, if the sun and the moon and the stars align, might pay for a short period if it starts as an acute situation. So, for example, when someone breaks a hip, there may be a period that Medicare pays up to 100 days.
But they're not addressing the whole thing. They're addressing the hip
just
part.
That short little period. And so once you get past that, you kind of get into the private pay sector. But for a lot of folks, that's not going to be doable for very long. And when I say private pay, I mean, you're writing the checks yourself.
Right.
And so then we look at, well, what sort of public benefits are out there that might assist you?
Are there public benefits out there?
There are. And one of the first ones that we're going to look at is Medicaid. Okay. Medicare is different than Medicaid. Medicare is the insurance that everyone gets, or at least most folks, when they turn 65 and they are eligible for that. But Medicaid is needs-based, which means they're going to look at your assets and they're going to look at your income. And so I help folks with being able to qualify for that benefit sooner rather than later, and hopefully maybe preserve some assets for them. Because if you have a single individual, you're not going to qualify for Medicaid until, and when I'm talking about Medicaid at this point, I'm talking about nursing home Medicaid. You're not going to qualify until you have $2,000 or less in countable assets. And that's a tough
$2,000, the gross of your assets, or $2,000?
Yes.
Whoa.
So you have to be destitute.
Yeah, pretty much. But there are things that we can do to plan, to assist, and maybe preserve some assets. And that's one of the things that I work with families on. It's very rewarding work because, you're getting people care that they need and hopefully being able to preserve something so they're not left with only just $2,000.
Now, when they go to these facilities that this pays for, are these, what are they like?
So the good news is that
there's good news?
Yes, there is good news. So in the Atlanta area, especially, all of the nursing homes in the Atlanta area do accept Medicaid. So often,
all of them.
Yes. So often someone will go into a nursing home and then eventually they will come onto Medicaid. They don't have to go to some nasty place in a dirty
part
of town.
Are there nasty places?
We hope that they're all striving to do the best, you know, job right. that they can. But some, you know, some places are better than others. But right. the good news is the really nice places are covered, just like ones that are maybe not as good.
So now if I'm in a nicer place and then I get to 2000, they can't boot me out of there, or they can? And is this where my lawyer is going to come in and help negotiate?
Well, hopefully your lawyer is going to get involved before you're down to the 2000, because if right. we can preserve something for you, we would like to do that. But once there's a Medicaid application, once you qualify and there's a Medicaid application in, they're not allowed to discharge you for non-payment. And the nursing home waits to receive, you know, waits for Medicaid, I guess, to go through that process, which sometimes takes a while. But then Medicaid will then pay. So you're not getting kicked out on the street. At least you're not supposed to.
Right.
Sometimes there are other reasons they can kick you out. So you kind of have to watch that. But you know, there are lots of ways that elder law attorneys can assist.
Now,
you.
Is Medicaid, you said it was need-based. Is it also age-based?
Well, yes and no. Nursing home Medicaid comes under the age, blind, and disabled portion of Medicaid. And so most of the folks that I have that are going into nursing homes are over 65, but not always. So, for example, I had someone last year who was in his early 60s and had an accident. And as a result of that in the home, and as a result of that, he needed the care. So we did need to go through this process of being able to have him determined disabled, because he didn't automatically qualify as aged. So, but you don't necessarily have to be over 65. So there are, you know, different circumstances in which folks find themselves in these circumstances. And sometimes it's really sad when you have early onset.
Because now that's happening earlier and earlier, right? With Alzheimer's?
There are early onset cases. So it is possible that someone would be impaired and need a high level of care before the age of 65.
So now in the perfect scenario, what age are people coming to you?
Oh, that's a good question. So when it comes to one of the things that we can do is we can pre-plan. And what we're seeing more and more is that folks are wanting to do that, mostly because they've seen a parent go through it and they don't want to relive that. So in those circumstances, you know, one of the things that we recommend is long-term care insurance. And the recommended age to look at that is the age of 50. And the reason for that is if you wait until after you've had some sort of incident, it's going to be harder to get that that insurance. So it's better to do it sooner rather than later. The planning that I might do with a 50-year-old is going to be different than the planning I'm going to do with a 70-year-old. But it's definitely something that makes sense. And unfortunately, I do see folks in their 60s more often than you would expect, sometimes because of unexpected things like a fall. And I've had that happen more than once. I had one client who had come in and a couple months before they had thought about, should I do long-term care insurance? And they decided, oh no. Well, the next thing you know, there's a fall and there's a need for nursing home care. And, you know, so, but typically, you know, you want to start getting things in place. And so you might start meeting with someone at 50, you might start doing some really significant planning at 65.
So now walk me through those conversations, that conversation that I come in with my spouse and I don't know anything. I'm having a conversation with you. What are some of the questions you're asking me?
Okay. Well, the thing about planning for these sorts of things is it's very specific to that individual's finances, family situation, and their values. Finances, because the planning that we might do with someone that has more significant assets is going to be different than the planning we're going to do with someone that has less significant assets. And then we're also going to talk to them about family dynamics. So when we're doing the planning, particularly the pre-planning, we're giving a lot of authority to others in order for them to do the necessary planning and maybe, you know, having assets structured in a different way so that a family member might be having control over that. And if you don't have a loved one that you trust implicitly, then that planning is not for you. Additionally, we look at a client's values. So for example, some clients that I have come in and they have worked so hard for the money that they have, and they may not have an awful lot. And sometimes it's more important to do the planning in those cases, but they want to make sure that they're able to pass on what they can to the next generation. Because when they worked hard like that, the idea was they were trying to do something for their family. And then other folks, on the other hand, are like, you know, I haven't accepted anything from the government my whole life. And, you know, goodness gracious, I'm not going to do it unless I absolutely have to. And so the planning that I'm going to do for them is going to be, those families are going to be different. So it's really going to be getting to know my client, getting to know their values, getting to know their situation, getting to know what their health situation is. Because, you know, sometimes we have a diagnosis, and so we know there's a really good chance that there's going to be care there that's going to be necessary. Other times, you know, there's not, and we have longevity, and we don't have a history, you know, a family history. And so when you do this planning, sometimes there are things that you have to give up. And so they have to decide whether or not they're willing to give those things up. But the bottom line is, if you come in and you are able to find out what the situation is, then you can make the decisions for yourself. And then instead of having those decisions made for you because you didn't explore those things. And so that is the key there.
But for some of the families, have they never had relationships with an attorney before? And this is like the first kind of regular sessions with attorneys?
Yes, that's true.
So how do you manage that? Is that something that are you charging them a retainer? Is this like a per project? Like how do you get paid?
Right. Well, it depends on the circumstance. I try and give a flat fee for my clients whenever I can so that they know what the cost is going to be and they know, you know, what to expect. There's some times when we can't do that. So if I'm doing guardianship litigation because a family member no longer has the ability to make decisions, responsible, significant decisions for themselves, that's litigation based. It's going to be hourly. But whenever I can, and particularly when I'm doing planning, I can usually tell them a flat fee of what to expect. The other thing is, some folks are really, really uncomfortable going to see an attorney because, like you said, they've never been to see an attorney before.
Only bad things happen.
Sounds scary.
It's intimidating, I'm sure, right?
It is. It is very intimidating. So we try and have an atmosphere that is, you know, much more congenial, comfortable, so that, you know, they can feel comfortable. And I think when they leave, you know, I think they do. There's often hugs at the end. And, you know, stuff
well,
like that.
This is
peace of mind. This is a touchy-feely area of the law. And as a result, you are building relationships. And it's really important because one of the things that I love about this area is that I'm helping folks through a really difficult time in most cases. And so you're trying to take that stress off of them. You're trying to let them know, hey, you have help. And just let them know that, you know, they're not in it alone and there's, you know, help to be had. And so, you know, folks more, you know, are very grateful to have that assistance, to have somebody there to help them.
Now, you mentioned long-term care insurance. Is that something you're helping them find? Are you selling that? Are you referring them to experts in this? Or is that part of your services that you're offering?
No, that's something that I'm going to refer them to a financial planner in most mm-hmm. cases for. And if they don't have someone, then I know some folks that are, you know, very knowledgeable in that area. It used to be that long-term care insurance was just what we call use it or lose it. So, you know, you'd pay all this money in, and if you never got sick, you were throwing the money away, which, I mean, that peace of mind is worth a lot. But a lot of folks weren't able to do it, or it was too expensive. But now they have these what we call hybrid plans. So it's a life insurance policy that has a rider for long-term care insurance. And sometimes that care is actually even better, that insurance that they could have got even if they had done the traditional use it or lose it. So it's really important that they speak to someone. And, you know, clients that are a little bit more financially sound, you know, they're also going to want to talk to their financial advisor about the possibility of self-funding their care, because that's a possibility as well, and that may make more sense for them, but they need to build that into their financial plan.
Now, when you're working with young people who are doing this on behalf of their parents, do you have like kind of a different kind of conversation? Like would you be open to having a conversation with somebody in their 30s whose parents are in their 50s that maybe the parents haven't even thought about it, but the kid is thinking about it because they've seen other friends deal with this.
Yeah. How do I bring this up with dad at Thanksgiving, right?
Right. Well, you had the opportunity to hear this radio program, and I would say use it. You know, mom, I was listening to the radio the other day, and there was this elder law attorney, and she was talking about long-term care costs and how much money it can be, and that you could plan for this. You know, have you thought about that yet? And so that's a great way to start the conversation because, you know, money issues can be really sensitive in families.
Right.
And sometimes parents have haven't really shared that with their kids. You know, it's an awkward conversation. It just is. But it can be really helpful. Or if that child does have an experience that a friend has gone through with their parents, use that. Share it with mom and dad. Typically, you know, folks are open, you know, to learning more about this because it's a secret fear of a lot of folks. And what we used to see, and we still see it, but not quite as much, is folks just not wanting to think about it until they have to. So kind of like planning for death, doing your will, you know. It's not a fun conversation, but it's an important one. And you get more control if you can get out ahead of it.
I can see my mom wanting to talk all day about it and my dad not wanting to talk about it at all.
Right.
I mean, I can just see that. I could see that dynamic.
Right. So to answer your question about, you know, talking with families and children, I do sometimes talk with children. In fact, particularly when their parent is already needing the care, that's often the point of contact. But when we are talking about parents' finances, it's their finances and technically they would be the client. So we would want to get mom and dad in so that, you know, I was directly having that conversation with them. And, you know, that parent might want to have their child involved, particularly as parents age, they tend to use their kids as advisors. But sometimes, you know, they're going to want to have those private conversations. And always I'm going to talk with a senior privately for at least part of that conversation, just to make sure that I'm effectuating their wishes. Because this is really about taking care of them as opposed to taking care of the kids.
So the client is the elder, not the child?
In most cases, yes.
Now, is there anything, like, does everybody need an elder law attorney at this point because of the complexity, or is this a nice to have?
I would say that everyone should see an elder law attorney. And if you did nothing else, then get a really good power of attorney with elder care provisions, then, you know, you're already ahead of the game. And the reason for that is if you wait later on when you're not able to make decisions for you, your family may not be able to do the planning at that point because they don't have the authority necessary to do so. So if you didn't do anything else, and this is not the power of attorney that you pull off of the internet, and it's also not the power of attorney that your, you know, just run-of-the-mill estate planner does. It needs to take into account elder care provisions. So that's the very most important thing. So for that reason alone, yes, everyone should see an elder law attorney. But we also do estate planning. So we're helping folks with either a will or a trust, depending on the circumstances. For seniors, a revocable living trust can be helpful because it allows someone to be able to manage their finances for them when they no longer are able to do so. So it starts off with them being their own trustee. And basically what a trust is, it's an agreement where one person holds something for someone else. And in the beginning, you are holding it for yourself and you're managing it for yourself. But at some point, if you're no longer able to do that, you've got a backup trustee set who can come in and just seamlessly begin to manage your funds for you. And so that's important. And also an advance directive. Everyone over the age of 18 should have an advance directive. An advance directive used to be called a healthcare power of attorney and a living will. And it does three things. The first thing it does is it allows someone to make decisions for you, for your health, when you no longer are able to. So anyone over the age of 18, your parents are no longer in that position that they once were, where they were legally that person that had the right to do that. So you want to say, is it that your parents that you want to make those decisions? A spouse, a loved one, a significant other, a partner, a friend? Who do you want to make those decisions for you? And then it allows you to say, you know, would you want the plug to be pulled under certain circumstances? And in Georgia, we're pretty conservative, so there's only limited circumstances that we allow that. But nonetheless, you want to get your wishes down. And then finally, it allows you to choose who you would want to be your guardian if ever you needed one and if ever you were not able to make decisions for yourself anymore. So everyone should see an elder law attorney. And the things that you might do with an elder law attorney are going to be different based on your age. So what you do when you're 30, you know, you may be ready to have children. You may have children. You want to put things in place like guardians for your children and decide who gets your property and who's going to manage that property if you're alive and you're not able to make those decisions. So pretty much everyone over the age of 18 could use an elder law attorney. You just might be seeing them for different reasons.
And then what percentage of people have wills or trusts?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I haven't actually seen a statistic on that. I will say that a number of them don't. I know.
But there's repercussions not having it, right?
Yes. Okay. So let's talk about that. So let's talk about, you know, a couple. They're 35, and it is a husband and a wife and two kids. And the husband dies and they don't have a will. So most folks would think, well, what he has goes to his kids or goes to his wife. But guess what? That's not exactly the way it works. Georgia is going to say that the spouse is going to share with the children. So the spouse will get a third under those circumstances, and each one of those children will get a third. And then a court will have to appoint someone to manage those children's shares. And they're going to have to account to the court every year for every dollar. And I'm pretty sure.
For how long?
Until they're over 18. And I'm pretty sure that's not what the husband thought would have happened if he died. So in other words, if you don't have a will or revocable living trust in place, the state of Georgia has a plan for you, and it might not exactly be what you think it is, and it might not be exactly what you want.
And then if you're getting a will, it's maybe not the best idea to go to, you know, the office supply store and get one there.
No. In fact, the document itself is probably the least of the things that we offer. The main thing that we're offering is counseling for you to determine what it is that you need and talk to you about what your options are so you can make those decisions to put the things in place that you're going to need when the time comes. And so a do-it-yourself will or a LegalZoom or, you know, something like that, it's not the same as sitting down with someone. And here's the thing, what most folks don't know is for a lot of folks, most of their wealth is going to pass outside of their will. It's going to pass via 401k designations, IRA designations, life insurance designations. And those designations may not say what you think they do, or you may not have done them, or, you know, whatnot. And so if you have those in place, and that's one of the things we counsel our clients on, what do these other things say? Not just what does that will do, right? Because if all you do is your will, you may have left out a large part of your wealth that's going to be passing in ways that you don't know. And again, you can't leave it directly to kids, or else you're back in court with that conservator again, having the court, you know, and even if your wife is the one who's ultimately, you know, set up with that, she's going to have to, you know, account to the court every single year. That may not have been your intention. And certainly, you know, I'm not doing that with my family. You know, I mean, that's not the way we work, you know, as families generally. So you definitely need more than just that, you know, do it yourself will, because you've missed a whole lot there with respect to things.
And if somebody wanted to learn more about your practice and maybe ask you some questions, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
So you can reach me at 678-609-3230, or you can email me at patricia@amari, which is amari firm.com.
And then Elder Law Atlanta, that's your website?
My website is elderlawatlanta.com.
That's good for you for getting that.
Yes.
That was a big score. Congratulations on that. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story today.
Thank you so much.
Hang with us. Got one more guest. The headliner, Miss Fontaine Huey with the Center for the Visually Impaired. Did you learn anything in that? You already knew all that, right, Fontaine?
I was fascinated. Patricia, thank you. No, really, I was taking notes.
What about mitigation? You knew that.
I had a whole different picture of mitigation. But what wonderful work, preserving land for future generations, which is the long-term objective. Absolutely. Of that mitigation. So that was fascinating.
See, there's a theme around this.
There is.
Absolutely.
So tell us about the Center for the Visually Impaired.
Well, at the Center for the Visually Impaired, in a nutshell, what we do is teach people how to live with vision loss. As a species, we humans are highly dependent on our eyesight. But if you were to suddenly lose some or all of your eyesight, that doesn't mean you couldn't have an absolutely wonderful life. What it does mean is you would need a very, very different complement of skills in order to access all of the information that sighted people rely on their eyesight to provide them.
Now, the other day, Stone and I were downtown. We had a meeting at Georgia State University, and there was a blind person with
with a white cane.
Right.
Yes.
And I was just, I couldn't even imagine just closing my eyes and just walking through down. I mean, there's streetcars. Like, how do they even know where the door is?
It's a skill. So white cane skills are really just the tip of the iceberg for what we call orientation and mobility skills. Again, think of the six of us around this table. We are sighted. We rely on our eyesight for landmarks, for visual cues. We're looking at traffic, all of those things. When that is removed, then you have to rely on other senses. The white cane is a tool. The white cane allows you to touch things around you. You can sense the texture of the sidewalk or the asphalt in front of you, helps you find trash cans, helps you find obstacles like all of those scooters that are now in the middle of the sidewalks everywhere you go.
The unintended consequences.
That's right. You also learn in orientation and mobility to listen differently. There's a conventional wisdom that we've all heard this in Hollywood, if you lose your eyesight, suddenly your other senses get better. It's not that they get better. You learn how to use them more effectively and more efficiently. So again, it's about a skill. It's being trained. So someone with a white cane trying to cross a busy street, they are listening to the traffic. There are certain cues they are listening for to tell which way the traffic is going, with them or against them. I won't pretend to give a lesson here on the radio.
How do they know where the door is, like in a building?
Well, some of that is asking for help. If you're in a totally strange place, you're looking for a door differently. You may very well have done research ahead of time. You're going to a building. You know it's on the right-hand side of the street. You know the door is halfway down. So with your white cane, you are moving ahead and you are finding the doorway. If you get confused, you may stop and ask someone, I am looking for, could you please direct me? Mm-hmm. And that will help. But most of the people I know who have strong white cane skills don't have any trouble finding doors.
Right. So we were waiting in the lobby and this
was incredible.
This woman, she finds a door, exits, leaves, and then comes back with food. Like they sent her out to bring
the food. They sent her for lunch.
Absolutely. Because she knew where it was. She knew where she was going. She had a mental map. So again, the white cane is just the tip of the iceberg. The skill of orientation and mobility is using your mental faculties that you are plotting out a mental map. When you and I come into a building like we did today, we're on the sixth floor. I was looking for signs, visual cues to find my way to the elevator, push the button in the elevator when I came out. If I couldn't see, then I would be tracking that differently and building a mental map.
So now, what are the services that the center is offering? Is it this kind of skills where you're teaching a person that maybe just lost their sight how to kind of maneuver?
We are a training facility, but we do serve people of all ages. We have four program areas, an early intervention program for infants, toddlers, and preschoolers. We have an after-school program for school-age children. We have a full training program for working-age adults who are trying to get back into the workforce. And we have a low-vision clinic, which predominantly serves senior citizens, which is why I was, on the edge of my seat listening to Patricia, because a senior citizen who is dealing with macular degeneration or glaucoma, they're thinking about all of these other legal issues. I mean, it opens up a whole different can of worms. So we're here literally from cradle to rocking chair.
So now a person that finds you comes in and then you determine what are the services that will best suit them?
Depends on the age. Infants, toddlers, and preschoolers are generally referred to us by pediatric ophthalmologists. So they come looking. What they are trying to do is help their children get the best start in life. Mm-hmm. And we have a wonderful early intervention program. The key of working with very small children, what we believe is very important, is working with the family unit. 90% of learning has a vision component. Those of us who have children, we think of how many times we said to our children, look at this, or did you see? The infant or the toddler doesn't necessarily know what they don't have. But their parents have to learn how to stimulate them differently.
Right.
A child who has vision loss, little or no vision, has to be stimulated very differently in order to reach appropriate developmental and cognitive milestones. So the early intervention program is really the family
unit. That's critical, right?
Critical, critical. If we can get those kids started so they enter kindergarten every bit as ready for an academic career as their sighted peers, they're a huge part of the way there.
Now, what percentage of kids have some sort of visual problem?
Blindness is a low incidence disability, but it's a profound disability, a high impact disability. So it is a very small percentage. If I had to guess, I haven't looked at the CDC statistics recently, but we're talking less than 1% of the population.
But you have enough to keep you busy.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and we serve metropolitan Atlanta, so we're serving the entire metro area. We're based in Midtown. Not everyone can get to Midtown every day. But yet, for a very young child or even a school-age child who needs these services, they need them on a regular basis. They have to grow. The skills grow with the child.
Right. So now, how did you get involved with the organization?
I got to know the organization through my predecessor. We were friends, and she started inviting me to the fundraisers, and I was just fascinated by the work that we do. And my core competency is nonprofit management and fundraising. So what does a nonprofit organization need but someone who knows how to run it and someone who knows how to fundraise? But I'm just fascinated by the mission. Almost everybody that works for us has a story to tell. We have an awful lot of employees who are blind or visually impaired. I can tell you they are every bit as nimble doing their job as I am doing mine, but they're using the technology differently. Technology has truly been a game changer for the people that we serve. I have an iPhone. My colleague Adam has an iPhone. He can find everything faster on his iPhone than I can, and his screen is dark because he is scrolling through it. Apple embedded voiceover technology in their phones from, I think, the second generation. Android now has voiceover technology. So all of the stuff that we do every day, a person who cannot see the screen can still do it, but they're doing it differently.
Now, as part of your mission to help with job placement and things like that?
Yes, it is. In our vocational rehabilitation program, employment is the outcome. And it's sad, but there are huge obstacles out in the community for anyone with a disability to find employment. There are so many misconceptions and misunderstandings and employers that are afraid it's going to cost them a fortune if they hire someone who has a disability. Most of those truly are misconceptions. The law requires, the ADA, Americans with Disabilities Act, requires reasonable accommodations. Reasonable accommodations don't cost a whole lot. So we work very hard. We work with the people to make sure the clients we serve in our Voc Rehab program, we make sure they have the skills to go back to work. We also help them learn how to present themselves differently, because when you go into a job interview and you have a disability, you need to address it right away. You need to put the interviewer at ease and make sure that they are not the least bit uncomfortable, because that's key to getting the job. We help people with their resumes. I want to backtrack for a moment. Many of our clients, when they lose their sight, they want a different job. I never really liked my job anyway, so if I'm going to be blind for the rest of my life, by golly, I'm going to do something I want to do.
How about that?
So it is one of those profound, wow, life-changing moments that take people on very different paths, which makes it very exciting.
Now, let's talk a little bit about fundraising. You said that's one of your important job functions. How do you get the word out and how do you raise funds for this cause?
Well, we talk to anyone who will listen. I think something that surprises people, I'm looking at Patricia, just like people are surprised that Medicare won't pay for long-term care. Most people are surprised that their health care insurance will not pay for any of their vision rehabilitation services. So if you're in a car accident and you lose the use of your legs, you can no longer walk, your health care insurance will pay for the acute care, send you to the Shepherd Center or someplace similar. You'll get all of that physical rehabilitation and the tools you need, and you can get on with your life. Same car accident, traumatic brain injury, you lose your vision. As soon as you are well enough to leave the acute care hospital, you are sent home. So We do radio shows like this. We have fundraising events like Dining in the Dark, which we had just about a week ago. We look for corporations that are interested in being good community citizens, corporate citizens, who will hire our clients, but who also will support our fundraising activities. But mostly we talk to a lot of people who know someone whose life has been touched by vision loss, whether their grandmother went blind from cataracts or they had a friend in high school who had limited vision. And we start telling our story and we ask them to help us provide the services to those people who can't pay for them themselves.
Now, do more people have visual problems as they age than are born with?
Absolutely.
Vision?
If you live long enough, you are likely to have some sort of age-related vision loss. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's just cataracts. That sounds so simple, but my grandmother went blind from cataracts. Cataract surgery that is so common today was not available to her, nor did she have health care insurance. But macular degeneration, glaucoma is a long-term degenerative disease. So in our low vision clinic, which as I said earlier, we serve mostly senior citizens, when a client comes to our low vision clinic, and they tend to be elderly and they're coping with vision loss, by the way, most vision loss is irreversible. Every once in a while, something happens and you get some of it back, but usually once it's gone, it's gone. So when they come to us for a low vision examination, they spend about an hour with a specially trained low vision optometrist who helps them truly understand what remaining vision they still have. Because sometimes if you can start seeing the glass full rather than the glass empty, that's the beginning of getting on with your life. You begin to find hope again. So the optometrist will help them understand what remaining vision they still have. Then the client will spend about an hour with an occupational therapy and have a therapy session. And the occupational therapist will show them an array of low-tech and high-tech strategies, tools, and devices that can help make life easier if you cannot see as well anymore. So it's the beginning of a process.
Now, you mentioned that last week was your event fundraiser. Mm-hmm. Do you have other events coming up?
We do. We're going to be celebrating White Cane Safety Day next Monday. We'll be down at the Sloppy Floyd Towers at 9:30. We're going to have a little kickoff and a proclamation, but we'll be there most of the day. And we have a wonderful art exhibition, Blind Sight. It's also on our website, cviga.org. The Blind Sight exhibition, they're photo portraits, but they also explain the range of vision loss. We also have a special needs planning workshop coming up tomorrow night, as fate would have it, at our building, 739 West Peachtree Street. The presentation is at 6:30, and it is really strictly, it's free. It's just an informational opportunity. Parents who are trying to set up special needs trusts and other planning tools that they might need. It's hard to find an attorney. So we have an attorney on our board and she is willing to just do this and provide information to get people started on the right path. So that's 6:30 tomorrow night at CVI.
So now how can we help? What do you need more of?
Oh, just spread the word. If you know anyone who is struggling with vision loss at any level, have them give us a call. Our direct line is 404-875-9011. You can also reach us at our website, cviga.org. If you call or email, you'll first be contacted by someone who is visually impaired, who has walked a similar journey, but can help you figure out what your next step is. And that's really what it's all about. Life is the journey. And all we have to do is figure out the next step. We don't have to figure it all out at once. So we're a tremendous resource for the metropolitan Atlanta community.
Well, Fontaine, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you for having me. It was delightful.
All right. This is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.